Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Lee Boyce. And coming up, the rise and rise of noisy neighbours. Fines are on the up, but what are your rights? We look at the danger of pricing your home too high and how to be a super NIMBY. Also today, grandparents and parents are digging deeper than ever to send kids to uni. But is it even worth it? Lee went back to school recently to talk to kids about money. But what did he learn? And why is having fun just so darn expensive nowadays? Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
I'm Lisa Kaplan from Charles Stanley Direct. I've spent 15 years helping people understand their finances with clear, jargon-free language. People often ask me whether they have enough to retire, what to do about inheritance tax, or how best to invest. Often, it's a simple question that one of my expert team can answer straight away, and we would love to help you too. Contact us for a free 15-minute chat at coaching@charles-stanley.co.uk. Investment involves risk.
But first, it's becoming increasingly hard to love thy neighbour, it would appear. Local authorities received more than 200,000 complaints about noisy neighbours last year, with fines up over 50% on the previous year. So what is going on? Simon Lee, welcome. Lee, are you a noisy neighbour?
I do have a small baby, so we obviously try and keep noise down to a minimum, but in the summer it is a little bit difficult when you've got a five-year-old and a baby. But I think on the whole we're not that noisy, I'd like to think.
I've got a couple of dogs. Again, they're not the quietest things.
No, they're actually the most complained about noise.
Well, I was going to ask you, this is all down to freedom of information request. Tell us about it. Dogs, be quiet. Mine are asleep at the minute by my feet, bless them.
So I think what's happened, I think the kind of loving of our neighbours from the pandemic is kind of over. We are really not happy with the amount of noise. And I guess it's a symptom of we are a little bit more on top of each other than ever before. But I also think that we're getting to a point where these things get officially complained about because neighbours aren't able to resolve the problem. So this FOI request was from Churchill. It showed local authorities received more than 203,000 complaints from residents about noisy neighbours last year, and actually fines for breached noise abatement orders surged 56% last year compared to the previous year. So that's when local authority gets involved and starts dishing out fines because you are being a noise nuisance. We got it mapped here where the majority of these complaints are coming from. So five of them, unsurprisingly, are in London boroughs, obviously the most
busy,
most populated bit of the country. And then there's Birmingham and Manchester make the list. North Lanarkshire is second in the list, actually, in Scotland, and Falkirk and Aberdeen are in there too. So it's dotted around, but obviously quite clearly very populous places, you are more likely to be running into these kind of noise complaints. But it just shows that I think that it's a huge rise. And huge rise in fines. So actually, local authorities going, yeah, well, you know, this is...
Again, I didn't realise that's how it worked. I thought people would have been calling the police or something. I don't know. Like, if I had a noisy dog next door, which I do, I didn't even know you'd call the council to sort it out.
Well, you wouldn't phone the police, George, would you? I mean,
well, no, obviously I wouldn't, but like, I'm pretty sure people
their
do.
Time. But I'm sure people waste police time in all sorts of manner of terrible ways. But really, what should happen in a noise complaint scenario is that you should try and resolve it, obviously, with your neighbour. But it's quite often not as simple as that. You know, you don't want to kind of rock the boat too much, and you know, do something that's then going to upset your neighbour and makes things worse and makes things even more awkward. And let's face it, you know, these are people that we live with, you know, live right close to, and you don't want to make things awkward. And going back to the pandemic as well, I think that, you know, noise complaints probably have risen somewhat as well because we're at home a little bit more. I think more people are working from home, for example, and are going, there's too much noise here. You know, I'm trying to work in my room or in my office or in my kitchen, and all I can hear is the neighbours. And I think there's a bit of that also going on. So Churchill then did a list of what's people are getting most annoyed about noise-wise. Number one, is dogs bark 51%. Totally live and breathe that. I can attest to that. Sometimes I hear dogs and I'm just like, oh, please just take that dog inside. Then it's parties and entertaining. If you end up with a neighbor that throws parties at all hours of the morning all the time, again, not great. Using DIY equipment, power tools. There's some around here. I constantly hear sawing and drilling. I've got no idea what's going on. Must have like a bit of a workshop in a garage or something like that. And number four is trampolining, which I'll come back to in a minute. And then it's kids playing in the garden, jet washing. I'm reading this list, and honestly, all of these things, not to a point where I'd complain, but there's definitely someone around here again that just loves jet washing every weekend, and I don't get it. And the weather gets good, and you think, come on, man, you don't need to be jet washing that again. Surely it's okay. But to go back to the trampolining, the reason why I mentioned that is because at the weekend, we did a story about someone that had written in saying that they were fed up with the next door neighbor's children, two children playing on a trampoline at weekends and after school, quite a low fence, and they're jumping over and looking
It's
over
the
the fence.
privacy, though, not rather than the noise, isn't it?
Well, I
That
think
really bugs me.
it's
Or
a combo.
both.
It's a combo, yeah. And I
Yeah.
think, you know, you if in your garden, you have a right to privacy without a doubt. But also, if you've ever lived next door to someone with a trampoline, it is quite an annoying noise, that squeak. You know, you just want to come and get some, some WD-40 or something. Say, come on, what is making this squeak? The springs, please, can we sort this out? But you know, I'm saying all this, and you can see why people get upset because, you know, garden. If you're lucky enough to have a garden, it's your sanctuary, right? And sometimes, you know, you want to go, and especially the weather's good, like it is today. One good day of summer we've had. In God knows how long, but it's nothing worse than when you sit outside and then all you can hear is a trampoline. I think parties are all right in the day. I don't really see a problem with that, but you know, the kind of annoying noises, the jet washing. You're thinking, why are you doing your jet washing today? Like, you know, it's 25, 30 degrees out. Just like, take a rest. But it's open for interpretation, isn't it, Georgie? And actually, on that trampolining story,
Isn't
just
it?
quickly, we had 3,500 comments on that story that we ran over the weekend. That is one of the most amount of comments I've ever seen in my life. The majority of people in there saying similar tales, but obviously there's people in there also saying, let children be outside.
Yeah, this
Like,
is
you
what
know.
I don't get. I'm going to ask you about what, because this was actually a reader question, and you answered it as to what that person's rights are. And it actually got a bit snarky. I mean, it's one of those instances where you message your neighbour and then it just all disintegrates, and then, oh, it's horrible. I'm listening to your list there, Lee. I don't know if it's because I've blasted my ears too much for years of radio, or I used to live under the Heathrow flight
So
path.
did
Like, I
I.
literally. It doesn't, I really, it just doesn't bother me. Saying that, loud eating really annoys me, right? Hearing people's music through their earphones really annoys me. Jet washing power tools doesn't bother me. Kids playing in the garden is a lovely
Yeah, but
sound.
there's a line, isn't there? There's a line that needs to be drawn, as in, like, you know, it's not annoying for short bursts or if it's like, you know, once in a blue moon. But if it starts happening every time you're trying to enjoy your garden and you're, listen, I've got no problem hearing children outside playing in the garden. It's a lovely sound. I think it's amazing to hear,
The
you know.
father of two says, our
Yeah,
children
and
playing.
but also as a father of two young children, you know, my eldest is coming up to six. She knows how to behave in the garden, and if she screams or kicks off or does anything, I just bring her inside and just calm her down, you know, because I'm just quite conscious. Like, I don't like to
I
think
tell
that
my dogs off for being
we're
noisy.
annoying the neighbours, you know. But I think that's where it all boils down to. And you're right on that trampolining question that someone got in touch with us about. You know, they try to resolve it, and the person, and this is where I go back to making relations worse. You know, you have to be polite and kind of be like, listen, you know, this is really getting to me. The trampoline, you know, the children keep on jumping and looking over the fence, and you know, it's just not very relaxing. I think that's fair enough, but then to then get a really nasty message back, and this is where you have to be very careful, and this
Can
is
I
why I think it's
recommend
such a
here
problem.
to everybody, just in life generally, if you have an issue at work with your neighbour, don't send a text, don't send an email. Speak to them face to face because it just leaves so much room for personal interpretation, doesn't it? Look, we could go down this absolute moral minefield of, you know, what's right, what's wrong. But we're a financial podcast. So there's a couple of things I want to talk to Simon about. I want to go back to the fines, because this I find quite interesting. That seems a massive rise in fines. But there's a cynical part of me that goes, were we always complaining? It's just councils are a bit strapped for cash now and they're going, ha-ha, there's a way we can get some money. And the other thing is, Switzerland have like quiet hours system. I mean, is there a system that we can kind of bring in, Simon, you think?
There's no easy answer. I mean, you could have quiet hours, couldn't you? I mean, you could do that thing where basically you say, you know, not within certain hours. Like you get it in buildings, don't you? No noise after certain times, or hotels or campsites. I used to have a neighbour with a noisy dog when I lived in London. And also I think people need to think about where they live, right? If you live in the middle of a town or the middle of a city and there's people all around you, you have to accept that there is going to be noise. It's just reality. You cannot expect a city to be quiet for you. But you can expect your neighbours to behave reasonably. And I think the point you made there about go and speak to them in person is literally the most important thing you can do. Now, chances are you could still end up having a disagreement with them, but they can't mistake your tone in the same way that they can mistake your tone in a message or in an email or in a WhatsApp or something. And never do it on like the neighborhood WhatsApp group or the building WhatsApp group. Never do that. Okay. Use your brain, people. But like the other way around, use your brain. If your kids are outside playing on the trampoline, great. They're outside playing on the trampoline. They're doing some exercise. They're not sitting inside on a screen. But if they are doing it all day long and driving your neighbors so mad that they've actually bothered to say something to you, because at the point where someone actually bothers to say something to you, for 95% of the population, that does mean that they've been sitting there enduring it for a really long time. Go, okay, I tell you what, maybe we could come to a compromise. We won't have them out there all day long doing it. We'll have them out there for a little bit. And people should recognize the things that, like, well, it doesn't bother me. It's like, yeah, but if you were sitting next to it and it wasn't your kids on it, it might bother you. And the same with everything. But I was going to say, I used to have a neighbour who had a dog. And he used to bark a lot. And two gardens down. It's fine. I accepted it. It was in London. But what was really annoying was this guy would then come out to his dog when it was barking, often at night time. And then he'd be like, shut it! Shut it! Shut up, you! Shut it! That was so much worse than the dog. So much worse than the dog. Well, which brings us back to, why is there a massive increase in fines?
Well, before we do that, I just want to say kudos to a neighbour recently of mine who was like, we've got a 50th birthday party, I think. There will be some noise, just to warn you. Nice little letter, smiley face. Mm. I thought, that's nice. Sent out to everyone's letterbox.
That's a good thing to do.
Good on them.
If you're going to have a big party or something like that, that is a good thing to do, I think.
Yeah, and also, that is a good neighbourly thing to do, because you can say to yourself, I don't want to be there that night then. You know,
exactly.
You can plan ahead and go, or go away, or go and stay, you know, relatives, or, you know, you can make plans then. You're fully expecting it. I think it's the ones where there's a sort of like completely unexpected and there's like, you know, noise going on to all sorts of hours in the morning. You're like, shall I knock now and tell them to turn it down, or now, or now? And then you don't. And then, but it can all have been saved with a little letter and a smiley face.
But to go back to the rise in fines, by definition, a private nuisance is a violation of your property rights. That's what it says in our article, the reply, whereby a substantial interference is caused to the ordinary enjoyment of your land. The interference must be substantial. The court will assess the noise suffered to determine whether a reasonable person would deem the alleged nuisance to affect the quiet enjoyment of your land, taking into account factors such as the time of night or day or night, its duration and its proximity to your property. But I think that, like, it's when it's just an ongoing thing. A one-off, I think it's highly unlikely people are being fined for one-offs. It is persistent antisocial behavior. And I don't think it is necessarily on the part of the people complaining who have just got less intolerant, although I think possibly we have got less intolerant. But I also think there is a bit of an attitude nowadays of, you know, I'll do what I want. It's my rights. I'm entitled to do X. And people just, the shutters come down. And I, you know, I think I blame the polarization of social media and the digital world for a lot of this. I don't think people are as considerate of other people as they used to be. Ironically, at a time when, you know, we consider ourselves to be much more considerate of people's differences and things like that, I think people are pretty rubbish nowadays at just letting things wash over them, or considering other people's points of view, such as maybe I should make a little bit less noise.
I do wonder, is there an issue as well? I know you said persistent noise, but I just remember when I lived in a converted Edwardian house in London, the noise was so loud from sort of, I thought the first time I arrived that the ceiling was coming in. I was above the shower and the floorboards. And I'm wondering if some of these sort of dodgy conversions into flats might also be a contributing factor.
Yeah, I lived in one of those. Well, I lived in two of those. One of them, our upstairs neighbours, when we first moved in, there was a lady who lived upstairs. And I think, if I remember rightly, she was a lawyer, worked for a city law firm. So she'd come back late from work. Mm. And you'd hear the front door go, obviously, which shook the internal wall downstairs to our flat, because it was, you know, converted Victorian building. And then you'd hear somebody go upstairs, which is fine. But then you'd just hear this clack, 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 because she's walking around upstairs with her heels on the wooden floor in the lounge. Fortunately, in this flat, the lounge was above the lounge, the bedroom was above the bedroom. But she probably didn't know, because we never said anything to her. If we'd have said something to her, I'm sure she would have taken her shoes off. And it only used to last like 10 minutes, so there's no point. Eventually, she'd take her shoes off. But in our other flat, which had been converted much more recently, and so should have been done under like modern building control rules. And so you trust in that. You trust that building control have done their job, and there should have therefore been like proper insulation between, you know, the floor of the extension in our flat and the ground and the ceiling, sorry, of the extension in our flat and the floor above. We took a wall down. And when we took the wall down, basically you looked up there, literally nothing. Builders just hadn't bothered. There's just a void. And that is the problem when you have, you know, scenarios where everybody lives on top of each other, like you said.
Lee, you've teed us up ages ago. The order's all wrong. It's absolutely my fault. Apologies, listeners, if we're going all over the place and talking too long about neighbours, but it's a fun and interesting subject. And Lee, as your article shows, 3,500 comments on it. But what are your rights? So this person wrote in, I pray for rain every day between 4 and 7 p.m. and at weekends. How far away from our boundary fence and how should a trampoline be under privacy law? Please, they go into the fact that relations broke down. We don't need to go in so much about those. But what are your rights? And I guess what's the reality?
There aren't really any rights, to be quite frank with you. So there's no specific legislation that provides a distance by which a trampoline should or should not be placed from a boundary fence. So essentially, if you want to put a trampoline in your garden, you can put it wherever you like. Now, there was an online petition from an elderly couple to the government asking for privacy laws to come in amid disputes involving trampolines. But the government said that it was rejected because it's something that it couldn't be directly responsible for, which is, to be honest, probably a response it uses quite a lot. So there are no real rights. And you could go down the noise route, but I don't think that this would qualify. I just don't think it would be seen as severe enough to be considered as a private nuisance claim. I mean, you can consider it and you could go for it. And the way to do it really is to keep evidence, you know, when is the noise occurring, tape recordings, how long it lasts, and the effects it's having on you, and keep any of the communications between you and your neighbour if they're abusive or, you know, not very forthcoming. So, you know, you could do that. You could get an independent acoustic surveyor in to measure the noise level. And then you could go down that route as well, where you could say, look, this is going over a certain decibels of noise on a daily basis, and I just simply can't take it anymore. But by the time you've rattled through and done all of those things, you know, probably winter will roll around and it won't be as much of a problem, and you won't feel it as much. But yeah, I could completely feel that. You know, in one way, this is kind of like, oh, it's neighbor wars, you know, it's quite amusing. But in other ways, this does really affect people's lives if it's a day in, day out occurrence, and it's making their life a misery. And it's, you know, we got to go out to trampoline and there's kids playing out in the garden. You know, what possible harm is that? But there's kids playing out in the garden on a trampoline for half an hour, laughing and having fun. Then there's kids having loads of people over, and the trampoline's right next to your fence, and it's right by where you sit in the garden, and it goes on and on and on and on, and they're constantly poking their head over the fence. And
that's the thing that, I mean, imagine if you had a neighbour who constantly popped their head over, like, I don't know, every 1-2 seconds, you know, for like 5 out 4 hours or something. Would that be allowed? I guess well, no, he exactly. wouldn't.
Well, exactly. I mean, and that's the thing. And then it's kind of like, you know, can you get a bigger fence? And usually you have to go, you know, there's rules around that. So it's a real minefield. And actually, we're going to sign off on this story with what you asked earlier. Are councils, you know, looking to basically make more money off of this, you know, cash-strapped councils? And actually, quite interestingly, in this research, there was three councils that accounted for more than 50% of all of the fines that were issued last year: Calderdale, Gateshead, and Burnley. So more than 50%. And basically, what these NAOs do, they tell the person what they must do to stop making the noise nuisance, or they're going to face further legal action. So it's not like you just all of a sudden someone turns off, goes, right, here's a fine, you're making too much noise. They will be informed that they're being investigated, and to sort of, you know, basically stop doing whatever it is that's breaching people's privacy rights. And a fine could be up to £5,000. Now, we have no data on how much these fines typically are. Mm-hmm. £5,000 sounds like a lot. But, you know, the reality is it's probably less than that. And if it's far less than that, is it enough of a deterrent to stop people keep doing it? Or will some neighbours just see it as a way of now making neighbours' lives even more of a misery, to a point in which in the end you just end up moving out? I think it's fascinating. I think that there's definitely something in all of this neighbour warring stuff. You know, it definitely feels like it has bubbled over way more in the last couple of years.
Interesting. We could go on for so much longer, but we've got plenty of other stories to get into, but we're going to stick with property. But selling a home. Now, everybody wants to get the best possible price if you're selling your home, but being overly ambitious can seriously actually backfire on you, especially if the price has to be reduced later on. And yet many sellers are still chancing their arms despite today's rather lukewarm property market. So, Simon, this all relates to some research from Rightmove. What have they been looking at? What have they found?
What they found is, understandably, there is a tendency amongst many people, particularly in a market that's a bit slower, like it is at the moment, to take a bit of a hit and hope approach. So what normally happens when you go to sell your home, if you follow the advice, is you get two or three estate agents around. They all tell you the asking price you should go for. And then you need to think about which one you're going to choose, which estate agent, obviously, and which asking price. Now, what you shouldn't do is just go for the one that tells you the highest asking price. What you need to do is go with the one that has the best chance of selling your home, that you think you can deal with, that you like dealing with, and so on. And then use the information that all three have given you on the asking price to decide your asking price. Look at other properties for sale, but also look at other properties for sale and whether they've been reduced, because there is a temptation to just go high and go, well, you know, we can always cut the price. But what happens is, often if you go high, nobody comes around and looks at your house, or not very many people come around and look at your house, or people come around and look at it and they go, well, it's a bit overpriced. And the problem that people are encountering and do encounter is that, being British, we're not very good at making an offer. Some people are. Some people love a cheeky offer. But lots of us go, what? You know, they're asking like 400. I don't want to offer them 350. That's a bit rude, isn't it? What if that's so low that they just totally offended and they won't even let us buy their house? Which, if you think about it, is daft. Because if someone's willing to pay what your house would cost, then you'll basically accept them as a buyer, unless they have displayed to you that they might be the world's flakiest, craziest buyer ever, and in which case you might go for someone else. But what happens is you can just end up sitting on the shelf, and then you have to reduce the price. And all people don't make you an offer because they think, well, they will have to reduce the price. They're doing the hit and hope thing. And I know that because I put my house on the market too in order to be able to buy their house. And I've done exactly the same thing. And nobody's making me any offers. So I'll wait till they have to reduce the price, which will be when I then reduce my price, and so on. And you just end up with this stagnation. And there is a counter argument from estate agents who say you should cut the price or you should go low. And that means that you then start to get enough interest that you then get people in a bit of a bidding war. And what you ideally need to get the most money for your home is at least two people who are very serious about wanting to buy it going up against each other. So they go, you know, I'll offer you 350 And the estate agent says, okay, well, somebody's actually made an offer to the other party that's interested. You know, are you willing to offer? And they say, well, what have they offered? And the estate agent says, well, I can't really tell you that, but you can usually wheedle some of that information out of them. And you go, all right, well, I'll offer 355. And then they say, okay, put it to the seller. And the seller says, okay, well, maybe we'll go to the other person, see if they'll go higher. And they go higher. And then you do best and final offers. And then you get 370. Whereas you might have only got 350 if you'd gone in at 400 and then had to cut the price.
I thought this was all part of the game, though. People overprice it and then you go in a little bit lower and then everybody negotiates and then we get to some sort of thing.
But if you go too high, people are not interested. They're just like, that's ridiculously expensive. There is that thing where if you think about, treat it like going into a shop or shopping for something online even. You know, price discovery. The reason why it's really difficult for shops to price stuff high, thinking, well, we can always get someone to pay that, is because of price discovery nowadays. All it takes is to take your phone out your pocket, Google the thing that you're looking to buy, and you can find out exactly how cheaply you can buy it and where you can buy it. Now, you might want to not want to buy it from the cheapest place, but you might be able to find it cheaper. So you've got a narrowing of it, okay? Mm. This is very true also of used cars. So Auto Trader has said this before, that basically the days of like being able to negotiate 500 quid off a, you know, £5,000 car are gone, because almost all dealers price it at what they know it'll sell at. They can see, they've got, you know, they can look on Auto Trader, but they're not looking at Auto Trader like you. They've got professional Auto Trader, so they know exactly where to price it. So that's why quite often when people go in to buy used cars now, they discover that the dealer won't negotiate with them.
Mm. Lee, how much of this is greedy sellers? Not even greedy. You don't want to get it wrong. This is a lot of money. Or is this estate agents?
I think it's probably a bit of a combination of the two, but I think that on the whole, it's probably more likely to be the sellers, because estate agents want the price of the home to be fair, because they want the sale done, wrapped up as soon as they can, really. You know, sellers also want that, but they also don't want to feel like they're underpricing the home. So I think that actually some of the comments from Tim Bannister at Rightmove for this story were really interesting. So saying, some sellers have struggled to adjust from the pandemic frenzy market mindset into the calmer market mindset of the last 18 months or so, and are being over-optimistic on the price they think they can achieve. Agents tell us that sellers often ask them to try to market their home at a higher price, thinking they can always just reduce the price later with no harm done. And he goes on to add, we can see in our data that being too optimistic at the start of marketing had detrimental effects on a property sale. So the bit of data here that he's pointing to is saying that the Rightmove research is saying that homes that haven't had their price slashed are 1.35 times more likely to be sold, and sales are half as likely to fall through. They also typically sell three times as fast. So it shows you it is important to price properly. And to take your estate agent's advice, you know, in terms of, I always think it's, you should get a few estate agents in through the door to come and value it. And, you know, sometimes, usually it's always going to be in the same sort of ballpark. You know, keep an eye on similar property stock in your area, you know, how much things are selling for, all of that kind of thing. But if you're over the top, if you price it over the top, and then you have to reduce it later on down the line, you know, it's that mindset of, well, if we've got to reduce the price later, there's no harm done. But, you know, that data tells you otherwise. And it's not a great look when you're trying to sell a home, because it just looks like you can't sell the home. And there's been definitely a few stories like this, I think, in the last few weeks that I've seen on social media blow up. Why isn't my X amount of home selling? There was one that's definitely gone a bit viral this week. And there's lots of people just putting, because you've priced it too high. Do you think that's what the issue might be? So it is important to get it right. And it is important to take, you know, the expert advice and not override it, because you think you know best because it's your home.
The only thing I'd say is when you are in a market where it's difficult to sell your home, and I say this as somebody who was trying to sell his flat in London and when we moved out pre-pandemic. So but we were trying to sell our flat in the Brexit negotiations year, right? Which was literally the worst time to be trying to sell, because it was just like a complete lack of confidence. Just nobody was really buying. The market just completely stalled. Which was ironic because then something much, much bigger and more important happened and everyone went nuts for buying houses during the pandemic. But, you know, never underestimate the ability of the British property market to do the complete opposite of what people think it will do. It's really difficult. And you've got an estate agent saying to you, you should just cut the price, take 50 grand off. And you're like, but are they just saying that to me? Because based on their commission, it doesn't make that much difference. Right, whether they sell it for price X or price Y that's 50 grand lower, what matters is that they sell it. Are they looking out for my best interests here, or are they just trying to get a sale so they get their commission? Because if your home doesn't sell, they don't get their commission, whereas if your home sells for 50 grand less, they lose like 750 quid, which if they're going to end up with like 3.5 grand's worth of commission or something, isn't that big a deal. So you do need to maybe take what they say with a pinch of salt and ask them the question, you know, honestly. This is why it's a really good idea to build up a really good relationship with your estate agent, is say, is it the price? Is it genuinely the price? And I must admit, fair play to one of the agents we used who said to me, it's not the price. It's really like just, he's like, even stuff that's really well priced isn't selling at the moment. And maybe ours was, you know, we should have gone in lower. But the problem is when you're in a market where confidence is slipping out of it, you go in at one price and then confidence slips out and you're like, oh God, now I need to go there and I need to go there and I need to go there. But what you need to remember is that even if you have to cut your price or you have to go lower, once you've got yours agreed, you are then in a great position to go negotiate on the property that you want to move to, which is almost certainly going to be more expensive in most cases. And you can negotiate on that. And if you negotiate the same percentage off that as you drop off yours, you'll save more money in monetary terms.
Mm. Some good tips there. We're going to stick with one more property related story. Lee Boyce, millions of homeowners bracing themselves. Thought it'd be a good thing as Labour has promised to build 1.5 million new homes. We're talking about what happens if you're not too happy with the developers moving in. How to be a super NIMBY. Do we want to encourage people to be NIMBYs?
I don't think people need encouraging to be NIMBYs. if I'm being honest, you're either a NIMBY or you're not. And I think without getting too kind of bogged down in this one and kind of, you know, there's obviously a lot of polarized viewpoints on this. And, you know, Labour have gone full steam ahead with their plan. 1.5 million new homes. We've discussed this on the podcast already, whether that is really viable in terms of house builders for one, and finding the right land, and this whole talk over grey belt, which is we've been sniggering a little bit in the office about, because we just like, what is this made up grey belt term, with some deliberation over what it is. And this got shared a little bit around on social media with some criticism, I should add, that, you know, we were encouraging people to become super NIMBYs. It's not that at all. I think there's a real difference between, you know, I hate the term NIMBY, like personally. I think what most people who you would class as NIMBYs are people that are worried about how land is going to be used in their local area because they care about it and they care about the infrastructure around it, and they don't want just some slapdash housing project to go up that doesn't fit akin to the area. And is a complete and utter mess. I think that is what it all boils down to. And all this story is saying is, if you're someone who is unhappy about a development that might be going up, whether it's in the last few years or, you know, and it's still in that planning stage or coming up because of these ramped up potential plans, it's just to figure out what you can do about it. I don't think there's any problem arming people with knowledge about if they want to fight something that's going on around them that they're not happy about. And why should we poo-poo people that do that? I don't understand. You know, it's up to people, isn't it, to decide whether or not they're unhappy. Yes, we need to build more new homes, but they need to go in the right place.
And we need the infrastructure around it, etc. Every development is different.
And every development is different. So that's why it's very hard to sort of just like club people from, you're a NIMBY. Oh, you don't want homes to be built, blah, 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 blah. You know, people get very passionate, and people are very passionate about somewhere that they might have roots in and have lived for a very long time. So I totally understand it. So really, simply put, is to find out the plan, find out everything you can about it and what's going to be going up what it is that's upsetting you. So get every single piece of knowledge that you possibly can, make sure it's up to date, make sure it's got all of the details in there. You could then sort of mobilize with neighbors. And yeah, we were just talking earlier about, you know, warring neighbors. You know, maybe this is where neighbors build an army. And actually, you know, if you're unhappy in a road and you think this is completely bonkers what's going on, you know, there is power in numbers. So you should probably mobilize with people that are in the area that might agree with you. If you find that absolutely no one agrees with you, then maybe you are just being, you know, an NIMBY for the sake of it and shouldn't be. You could then create a petition and start getting signatories for it to try and block it. And just basically just harnessing all of the skills, you know, within your community. You know, to do it alone is very difficult, but to do it with other smart people that live in your area makes it much easier to fight these things. They're likely, you know, more contacts, more knowledge, and, you know, there is a possibility that you can, it's not necessarily that you don't want this project to be built, for example. Let's say it's some big project. Maybe it's just that you're unhappy with the way it's being done. Maybe you're unhappy with what the housing stock is that's going up. Maybe you're just upset because, you know, it's a piece of greenbelt land that you never expected to be built on. And when you bought your home, you never expected this bit of land to ever be built on because you were kind of told it wouldn't be. Now, there's lots of different reasons, but arm yourself with the knowledge. And I always think with a lot of things in life, you should fight it if you feel passionate about it.
Yeah, fair. I mean, it makes us go full circle back to the first story about complaining about your neighbours and noisy neighbours. A lot of these developments are being built in areas that are already very built up. And you can imagine that if we had a lot of complaints now, we'll have a lot of complaints in the future. I assume that's all looked into when these planning applications are put in. But Simon, what are your views on being a super NIMBY?
I wrote a column about this some years ago that we talked about. You might remember this acronym, lay-by. I said, I have a problem with the term NIMBY. And I said, well, you know, the thing is basically lay-by, look after your backyard, right? Because if you don't look after your backyard, who will? If you don't look after the area that you live in, and that doesn't mean refusing all new home building, just to be absolutely clear, but it means trying to make sure that any new home building is the right kind of homes in the right places and done well. If you don't look after it and get involved, who's going to look after it? Are the people building the homes? No, they don't care, right? And I'll tell you why they don't care in a minute. Is the government? Not really, because it's basically, well, our new government has promised to build 1.5 million homes and it's going to be held to that. The last government, they didn't really care either. You know, they'd also promised to build a load of homes. And actually, it's a misnomer to think that they didn't build that many homes. They built more homes than people think. And it was the COVID and then rising interest rates that have killed off home building in the last few years. And actually, people have short memories because I remember the Barker Review, which was under the Blair and Brown government, where there was a big fuss because they wanted to build up lots more home building because they felt they weren't building enough homes. Nobody ever feels like they're building enough homes. And actually, the homes that we aren't building, it's not really like homes for people to buy. It's social housing. We sold off all the social housing and then we didn't build it back, which was a big mistake. But the government's not going to care. The people who care are the people who live in the areas and the people who represent them in the areas and quite often the local councils. And they get a lot of criticism, but the builders don't care. And this is one of the big problems that I have with some of the rhetoric around this, and which is why I think it needs to change slightly. One of the big problems of building in this country is that it is massively concentrated into a very small number of very large building firms, okay? And that number is getting smaller because there's a couple of mergers and takeovers going on within the industry. And that means that the people making decisions on where to build the homes and building the homes have no real vested interest in the local area where they're building the homes. When you had lots more smaller house builders, they tended to be located in an area. And so their reputation mattered because they were the house builder in that town, in that city, or one of a number of them. And people knew they'd built those houses. And if those houses were crap, or those houses, you know, didn't have big enough gardens, didn't have enough space, all that kind of thing, didn't look nice enough, their reputation suffered. Nowadays, you've got your Bellways, your Persimmons, your Barretts, and so on. They don't care. People making decisions there, they're making decisions based on how much money they're going to make off those properties, what that's going to be on the bottom line, and how big their bonus is going to be, and how big their salary is going to be. And frankly, you only have to get in a car and drive across the UK and see the bits where they are building big estates and new houses on the edge of towns, totally bland, soulless. They always look weirdly windswept for some reason. I never could quite work it out. They plant some trees and stuff, but those trees are going to take for a long time to grow. You just look at them, you just think, that looks just like the one that I saw about like 15 miles down the road and so on. And they just slap them up. And there's been a big problem with the quality of housing, people being ripped off over leasehold, all of these other things. And the biggest problem with building houses in this country is that for some reason, people in local areas, despite the fact that houses in their area would quite often benefit them and their families, you know, one of the biggest problems is people not being able to buy a home in the place that they grew up in, are anti it. And the reason is because of poor quality housing, poor quality developments, not enough infrastructure, the schools, the hospitals, you know, the roads are full, the trains are full, and so on. And you need to change people's mindset. So they go from being the build nothing nowhere ever to actually, I want those houses near me. I would be proud to have that built near me. And I think one of the issues with the Green Belt, Grey Belt is funny. They have just made it up. The Green Belt, Grey Belt thing is like, it's all very well saying, well, there's this petrol station and that's Green Belt and there's these bits of scrubland and that's Green Belt. And it's just like, yeah, but if they were easy to build on, they'd have been built on already. Mm. Like the easy thing to build on is fields. Developers love building on fields because you just basically, you option it with the farmer. They get lottery style money off the back of like, if it gets planning permission, you build the houses, make out like a bandit, everyone's quids in. And it's really, really easy. But what happens is the people who lived close to countryside suffer the most. But the people in the town suffer the most because the countryside that was used to be 10 minutes away from them is now 20 minutes away from them. I say this from a point of like massive privilege, okay? I live in a nice house. And do you know what? It's on the edge of the countryside. And I grew up in a house on the edge of the countryside near a town, right? So that means I appreciate two things. One, I do appreciate the countryside, but two, I've also seen all of the people, you know, from the towns and how much they appreciate. And we never saw this more than in COVID. And the problem is if you shift the countryside another 15 minutes away from everyone or another 20 minutes away from everyone, that's to the detriment of all of those people who live there. And they see no benefit from those houses being built. You know, developer makes out like a bandit. Farmer gets lottery style. Yeah, we're talking like £4 million sometimes. You know, it's like literally like they've won the lottery. And all the people in the local area, they don't get anything. The money doesn't go back into the local community. And that's a problem. I think there is a very strong argument, and this has been put forward, capping the amount of money that goes to the person releasing the land and everything, and the money goes back into the community. But you also need to build better. Pull the countryside in. Like, don't just sprawl it out. You build spokes of countryside coming in so that people aren't pushed away from the countryside. The countryside still continues to come into them. But I hear none of this. I hear none of this, and I see no evidence of this in any of the stuff that's being talked about. And to be fair, I saw very little evidence of it under the Tories either, or under the previous Labour government and so on and so on. And I think we need to like radically rethink how we're doing housing so that people actually want it rather than just imposing it on people. Rant over.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Alex Webbone from Charles Stanley Direct for our regular Investing Explained feature. Alex, welcome to the podcast. We've got a reader question. I want to pay £5,000 into my pension. Should I do it now, all in one go, or spread it out?
Thanks, Simon. Yes, ideally you want to spread it out a bit over the course of a few months, for example. This is because you want to avoid investing the money at what could be the top of the market. So by that, we mean when shares and funds are at their most expensive. And by spreading the payments, you can smooth out some of that volatility. We call this pound cost averaging, and it's a popular and well-known investment technique. We usually advise against people trying to time the market, as it's very difficult. So a mantra that we commonly tell people is what counts is it's time in the market rather than timing the market.
Does that mean that in future, our reader should invest smaller amounts more regularly?
Yes, investing smaller amounts regularly rather than lump sums means you benefit from the pound cost averaging I just mentioned. So when the asset price is high, your money will buy fewer shares, but when the price drops, you benefit from the same amount buying more shares. The easiest way to do it is to automate the process by setting up regular payments from your bank account the day after you get paid.
Alex, thank you very much.
Thanks, Simon.
Welcome back. Move over the bank of mum and dad. When it comes to higher education, it's all about the bank of gran and granddad. It's not all about them, but it's a fair amount at the moment because the amount they're contributing to their grandkids' university costs has increased to an average of just over £4,700 a year. But you also have on your website an article, quote from anonymous author, "University is my biggest regret. I earned £70,000 and it's still not enough to pay down my student loan. So would the money be better spent elsewhere?" Lee, grandparents spending all their money on university, but what's the point?
Well, the point is they're helping out people that want to go to university with, increasing sort of accommodation costs, tuition fees that are fairly high compared to historic standards, and they're having to tap up relatives in order to do so. So this is an Association of Investment Companies piece of research suggesting that a quarter of parents reported that their children's grandparents are helping to pay for uni costs, and they're given an average of £4,703 per year. That's up from £2,455 in 2013, far outstripping inflation. And at the same time, 71% of parents contribute to their children's uni costs, giving an average of £8,723 per year. That's quite big, chunky numbers that are going out there helping children and grandchildren through university. And you're right, we had a column this week from an anonymous reader who got in touch, who we basically did a... I wanted us to do a really like big deep guide on if you're 17, 18 years old, read this, all about student loans, everything you need to possibly consider before you take out a student loan. And the reason why we did that is because whenever I read comments about student loans, it always appears that students that are signing up to these just don't read any information about student loans whatsoever and don't really understand how it all works and where it's going in the future. So we did this guide and then someone got in touch and said, yeah, uni is my biggest regret. But, you know, again, this is sort of polarized a little bit of, the kind of audience here. You know, this person saying they earned £70,000 and it's still not enough to pay down my student loan. I don't want to get into all of the nuts and bolts about student finance and student loans because I know it's a very, very, very sort of conscientious. It's one of those topics where, like, I feel you've got one half of people that will say it's a graduate tax and it should be treated as a graduate tax, and it's not actually a debt. And then other people that just cannot understand how levels of debt this high can be racked up. And there was actually data in the last couple of months for the student loans company showed that nearly 2 million people now owe between £50,000 and £100,000, with one person owing £252,000 in student finance. That's a lot of money. My viewpoint of all this and my viewpoint on this column and the reason why we ran this column is that there's a lot of people out there who went to university when it was far cheaper to go to university. Tuition fees were far lower. Living costs were far lower, might have come out with a student loan, but have managed to chip away at it, especially after we had a kind of decade of, relatively low inflation, which is what a lot of the student loan finance repayments are based on. So they've managed to clear the debt. It's starting to bite now, I think, for those who are kind of in their early 30s backwards, so going down from that scale, who are getting their pay packet and seeing this money coming out, rightly so, you know, to pay off the student debt, the student or graduate tax, or however you'd like to frame it. What's frustrating, I think, for people, and the feeling that I get from the commentary I read, we've had lots of emails in, again, people say, thanks for writing this story, because I feel like I'm in exactly the same boat. I think people can't take the fact that they've come out with the student debt. They know they're coming out with student debt. They understand that. They can't understand that they're earning a decent salary and only covering the interest of this loan, and the loan continues to go up and up and up. And you could say, well, okay, well, that's going to get written off after 30 years. It's going to get written off now after 40 years. Mm-hmm. If you're in a recent cohort of students, graduates, that's a long time to be having that money come out of your salary. You could, you want to pay it off. You're happy to chip away at this and fairly pay it off. But I think what people are battling now against is a couple of years of where we've had high inflation, where these are linked to inflation, not even covering the interest, and you're constantly seeing that number tick up, and we're getting a big chunk of people who are starting to earn fairly decent salaries. Would they have earned those decent salaries if they hadn't gone to university? Possibly not. But it's still very difficult to take that you're not paying off
that. Yeah, absolutely.
I'd find that really difficult to take. I find that if I came out with a £50,000 student debt, I came out of university with a £30,000 student debt, and that's when tuition fees were capped at £1,200. And I didn't even really, I think I had to pay half my tuition fees because I was from a single parent household. I lived in London because I did my university degree in London, so most of it was accommodation costs. Mm-hmm. And I only paid it off in the pandemic. I paid it off, and I could see the balance going lower and lower and lower. And that was a nice feeling, Georgie. I get the impression there's quite a lot of people that are not going to be in that position now, that it would come out with 30k now or 50k now, and it just feels like it's not going anywhere. It's not being chipped away at because it's been such high interest. And that's where my viewpoint is of all of it. And I think sometimes people comment on all of this without actually having lived through it, without actually having realization that these are some pretty chonky payments that are coming out that basically are just covering interest.
And that's why we're seeing more grandparents and parents trying to help out.
Exactly. One and more you can help out, and we've had this conversation before. It's why I'm saving very hard for my children. Not everyone's lucky enough to do that. But I'd kind of like, if one or two of my children like to go to university in the future, fantastic. I'd always encourage it, always. But I'd like to help out as much as possible. Just because, and who knows where student finance will be then. Who knows? But you can understand why parents and grandparents are getting involved.
Simon?
I think the whole thing is a mess. And I think one of the biggest problems is the interest being charged on the loans, which, has been very, very high due to high inflation. I also think that a lot of people don't really understand what they're getting into when they take it out. I think that we either need to decide whether education is a public good, and therefore we do subsidize it to the tune that we used to subsidize it, or we decide that university education is not a public good and therefore we stop subsidizing it. I don't think what we should be doing is lumbering people with the colossal debts that we're lumbering people with. I would advise all people involved to not do the maths about the what my degree might end up costing me, because there's a lot of what ifs there, it's going to be a scarily big number if you start trying to work it out. I think I suggested before on this podcast, actually, something I think we should have is, I think students should get their own version of the triple lock. The interest rate they should be charged should either be the lowest of base rate, CPI inflation, or 2%. Because if the government and the Bank of England can't keep inflation under control, that is not students' fault.
Agreed. Right, we're going to stick with education, because Lee, you went back to school recently to talk to a bunch of 10-year-olds about money, while doubtless imparting these massive pearls of invaluable wisdom to 10 and 11-year-olds. Lee, what did you yourself learn, I wonder, from the experience? Tell us, what were you doing in school, Lee?
There was a call around that went through the school newsletter asking for parents to come in to talk about their jobs for something called Maths Day. And I'd seen the newsletter message come out a few times and I'd kind of just ignored it. And then my wife was like, come on, you should do it. You should do it. Maths is obviously quite a big part of your job. I mean, the main part of your job. And you're a journalist, and I think the children would quite enjoy it, hearing about it. And I was like, nah, honestly, I really don't think they would. Anyway, cut long story short, she finally convinced me. I went in, I did it. It was a class of year 6 pupils at my daughter's local school. They in little groups of six, they came, sat and listened to me do a little talk, and then they asked me questions. I thought they would be bored out of their minds. I thought that they would, you know, what would possibly be interesting about, you know, someone writing and editing stories about pensions, investments, savings, you know, for 10, 11 year olds. And these children, obviously on the cusp, it's their last day of school today. You know, they'll be going into secondary school in September. And they are very, very, very curious at that age and very interested in the outside world. And I realized very quickly that I should have just put my hand up in the first place, because it was really fascinating listening to their questions. And they range from all sorts, Georgie. When someone asked me, how much money do I need to earn to be happy? I mean, it was really sort of like profound questions that you'd have in like a self.
What did you answer, Lee?
Well, it was
a question,
it was,
eh?
It was such a difficult one to answer. And like my kind of response was, you know, I kind of bumbled my way through it, talking about, you know, job satisfaction and what work-life balance being important, salaries important. But I'll be honest, I was quite stumped by it. They're impressionable children. You don't want to kind of like say, yeah, earn as much money as you can and buy all lovely things and, you know, it will make you really happy. Because the truth is, and even just going to this event, sometimes there are things that money can't buy that do make you happy, including going to that, because I stepped outside and I was like, that actually made me really happy speaking for 90 minutes to those children. And it felt good. It felt kind of like nice to feed the enthusiasm. It felt kind of, they were super interested in people interviewed, stories that have been written. You know, I tried to make it as kind of like focused on 10 and 11 year olds. I mean, they all kept on asking me if I'd interviewed Cristiano Ronaldo stroke Taylor Swift, but I kind of had
interesting personal finance angle for both of those, I think.
Yeah, well, Taylor Swift had plenty of Swiftonomics articles written about her. So yeah, it was, and it was really good. And I've come away thinking, you know, should do more of it, should actually do more of these kind of talks. Doesn't matter what your job is. You know, they want to know about the outside world, and rightly so. And I kind of try to talk a little bit about money and, like, you know, how maths is important in terms of, you know, our finances. And also, you know, my 5 year old has some very like interesting money questions, you know, because the concept of money for a 5 year old or a 10 year old is quite hard to kind of comprehend. And she does keep on asking me at the moment, why do you have to have a job when you're older? And it's kind of like, I don't want to just come up with some sort of like trivial response. So I've been kind of like saying, well, you know, we've got a house and a house needs a mortgage and a house needs paying for. And then if you want holidays, you've got to save for holidays. And then I kind of stop it there and try not to overload her mind. And actually, just to finish up on this, a few days afterwards, I received a load of handwritten cards made by the year six pupils, and I got a bit teary, Georgie. Kind of realize that, you know, you can help shape curious minds. And yeah, it's like you open up one of these cards and it said, you really inspired me to be a journalist. And I thought, oh my god, no, don't be a journalist.
Yeah, you're like, no,
don't
I was thinking all these accountants, and you're like, oh god, journalist, no, don't do that.
how much money do I need to earn to be happy? Well, you're not going to find the answer to become the journalist. But in all seriousness, it kind of made me realise that, you know, it is important to do these things. And it was a fantastic afternoon. And I would actively encourage anyone that ever gets invited, lucky enough to get invited to do something like that, to do it.
Well done, Lee. Problem is, though, as the kids grow, they'll want to go to a lot of fun stuff, won't they? That's what kids want to do. It's what adults want to do. You know, want to go to football match, the tennis, ballet, I don't know. But gigs and stuff. Problem is, they are so expensive nowadays. Wow. I was looking at going to the T20 final, I think, at Edgbaston on one of them. 145 quid, I think it was, for the start tickets. That's, come on, people. What is going on? In particular, music fans now spend an average of £470 on festivals each year. And it's not working out for the festivals and the events either, because by all accounts, around 50 have had to be cancelled this year because people simply can't afford to go. Simon, I know you're a big fan of these sorts of things. What's going on?
Not a massive fan of festivals. Big fan of going to gigs.
There you go.
And go to, you know, any number of them over the course of a year, and have done, you know, every year of my life since I was in my early teenage years. And I've got the tickets to some of the old ones, you know. And this is something that I think is really unfortunate, because not only have prices gone up so much, but you don't get your physical ticket anymore. And you just can't, you know, stick a printout, or nowadays a QR code on your phone onto your fridge in the same way. And there's something wonderfully nostalgic about that, you know, 1992 Guns N' Roses Wembley Stadium ticket that I've got, or the Oasis at Nebworth ticket that I've got. Oh, nice. You know, all those tickets over the years. So hats off to the bands who still actually send out tickets or give you the option to have tickets. Funnily enough, actually, with the football and the cricket now, they quite often offer you the opportunity to buy the ticket as a souvenir. You don't actually use the ticket. You just get sent the ticket at a later date.
Yeah.
Honestly. But the prices are off the charts expensive. You know, I think Taylor Swift tickets started at 95 quid. I couldn't get Taylor Swift tickets, unfortunately. My girls were very disappointed. Mm. You had to go into a ballot. I prefer the thing where you just basically have to go on at a certain time and you've just got to battle it out, because I've never failed to get tickets under that. But, you know, last year we went, took them to see Harry Styles. Harry Styles tickets were, I think they're over £100 each. By the time you pay for them, that's just like, you know, normal seated tickets. But some of these massive acts, you are looking at £100, just over £100. And that adds up, you know, for a family. Even like, you know, middle run bands quite often will be charging, you know, 50, 60 quid. And sometimes what happens is you see bands and they come around again, and then all of a sudden the ticket's gone up like 25 or 30 quid. You're like, what are you doing? There are some bands who, I must say, still keep their ticket prices low. One of them, I don't know if they still do it, but I can't even remember the last time I saw them it being as expensive as it could have been. Is like the Arctic Monkeys have always done that. Hot Chip, every time I go see Hot Chip, their tickets are great value. Well done, Hot Chip, if any of the members of Hot Chip listen to this podcast, right? But one of the problems here is the secondary ticketing market. And this was a big thing.
Yeah.
Okay. We've long campaigned against the secondary ticketing market and the fact that it is basically a bedroom ticket touts charter. And real life ticket touts don't like the secondary ticketing market. They liked the, like, you got to put some effort in to get the tickets. And they see themselves as kind of facilitating people who don't have tickets they don't want, and then it's people who have tickets they need and so on. Whereas this is basically go on a computer, hoover up some tickets, whack them on immediately for a very high price. Mm-hmm. Now, these secondary ticketing agencies, you know, when this problem first emerged, and we're going back over 10 years here, maintained, we're just helping fans sell tickets that they don't need. And it's just like, what, you mean the fans who bought the tickets and then 5 minutes later realized that they couldn't actually go? It's astonishing how many people are like that badly organized, exactly. Isn't it? And lo and behold, I bought these tickets. They went on sale this morning. I can't go. I'll just put them up on, you know, for 50 quid more per ticket. And the problem is, right, artists tend to price gig tickets below the price that they could actually sell, the maximum price that they could sell them for, because they want the fans to go. They want to reward the fans. That system has been eroded by the secondary ticketing market, because they then see those tickets going on the secondary market for 50% more, 100% more. And the promoters and the artists look at it and go, well, hang on a minute, right? People are paying 100 to go to the gig and we're selling them for 50 and we're getting none of that. That's all going to some tout. And they fought against it. And to be honest, you know, people haven't really won on this. And so you've started to see that eroded. And they're like, well, you know what, let's just go 75 then. It's not as high as the 100 that the touts are selling them for. And the touts still sell them for more anyway. And then you've also had the bit where live music has become so much more important in terms of the income streams of artists. And so they're having to try to make more money from the live music, because they're not getting the money from the recorded music. And then to go on to the festival thing, it's got much more expensive to run a festival. Everybody suffers from inflation, but the inflation, the wages, all the kind of stuff that goes into it means it has got much more expensive. And there's just way too many of them. You know, you've got festival inflation in terms of ticket prices, but you've also got festival inflation in terms of the sheer volume of festivals. And they all book these massive lineups, and then they discover that people can't go to them. And then they're kind of, I think what we've seen is the boom and bust phase of festivals. And it just means that people are being, you know, asked these unbelievable prices to go. But Glastonbury sells out every year, and you know, and then some. People are queuing to queue to buy their Glastonbury tickets, even at that sky high price.
You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. If you have any comments or questions for the team, anything you'd like them to look into, any comments you've got to make on the show. Simon.
You can email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney or come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
I'm Lisa Kaplan from Charles Stanley Direct. I've spent 15 years helping people understand their finances with clear, jargon-free language. People often ask me whether they have enough to retire, what to do about inheritance tax, or how best to invest. Often, it's a simple question that one of my expert team can answer straight away, and we would love to help you too. Contact us for a free 15-minute chat at coaching@charles-stanley.co.uk. Investment involves risk.